in fetal surgery, it was so brand new to the world that there were no guidelines, and certainly no techniques or devices. So we had to make them all up.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Health Technology Podcast. My name is Christine Minotto, and I'm the director of the Roseman Institute at UCSF, University of California in San Francisco. UCSF is best known for its research and high standard of medical care. It has some of the leading surgeons in the country. We are proud today that we will be speaking to one of them, Dr. Mike Harrison. Dr. Harrison is famous for being the first surgeon to operate on human fetus in the womb. In this new area, he had to invent a lot of techniques and devices. He's a true pioneer and founded the Fetal Surgery Center here at UCSF and a group called the Pediatric Device Consortium, which promote technologies that serve markets such as newborns with rare defects. One of his specialty is the use of strong magnets. He is currently commercializing two magnetic devices, one for sleep apnea called MagNeb, and Dr. Harrison founded another company called Magnemosis that commercializes the other devices which make connection in bowels. So if you like what you hear today, please write a review on iTunes and subscribe and enjoy the talk. Welcome, Dr. Harrison. Thank you for joining me today. So you are one of the pioneers for the fetal surgery here at UCSF. Maybe you can start from there. How do you get your passion and how you end up being, you know, wanting to become a doctor? Do you know that since very early stage of your life?
I did, because I grew up in a small town in the state of Washington, and my dad was the general practitioner, so he was the town doctor. So, and I very much admired what he did, him, and so I sort of had that from an early time.
And then what? so after high school?
Then I went away to college and medical school on the East Coast. A really funny thing happened when I started my surgical residency at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. The very, very early on, when I didn't know anything about surgery, I just started, I was exposed to a pediatric surgeon named Hardy Hendren. And these beautiful operations on babies. And I was so taken, I just decided from the very beginning that I'd probably do pediatric surgery. The other thing that happened
is... What is the operation that make it so beautiful?
Well, operating on little tiny babies and having them be fixed. So the one that, there's a very striking example that started the whole fetal surgery deal. So a baby was born, I was the intern, with the diaphragmatic hernia. So they're missing a piece of their diaphragm. Their guts all go up in their chest. And so I helped this great pediatric surgeon repair the thing, and it was just beautiful, except for one thing. The baby died after, and this is typical of diaphragmatic hernia, because it's not just that the diaphragm isn't there and the guts are up. It's that the lung doesn't have room to grow. No one really appreciated that at the time, but I was so naive. When I looked at this kid who died a couple of days after the operation, I said, you know, this kid didn't die because he had his guts in his chest. He died because his lung's not big enough. And the only way I can think of to make that lung bigger is to do something before birth. Let the lung grow when the kid's inside his mom. And that's the only way to really overcome that problem. That pediatric surgeon just about fell down. He was so shocked at how stupid that was because no one had ever heard, I mean, he even thought about doing something before birth. Because, you know, that was the time essentially before real ultrasonography, before we could see inside the uterus, before it was just a mystery. The whole fetal life was just a total black box mystery. So anyway, that's what got it started. I kept that idea. And
throughout medical school,
throughout residency training, and then pediatric surgery training, And the reason I came to UCSF, I'd never been here. I'd never been to San Francisco. But I heard that this was might be the place where you could do something radical, like fetal surgery, like the first fetal surgery. And one of the reasons was not the surgery or the surgery department or all my colleagues. It was that there were a bunch of crazy, really cool scientists, cardiologists, pediatricians, who were studying fetal development in a fetal lamb model. So they had figured out how to operate on the fetal lamb, keep it alive, do all that stuff, and do things to it. They were doing mostly measurements and diagnostic stuff, but I said, I could take that same model and see if, that what we're thinking about is correct. And that's how, so when I came here for that reason, I got to do that stuff with them. And
but not knowing that you are allowed to do that.
Right. Oh, yeah.
How do you break through that?
Well, in those days, it was quite different because in those days, you could just do it. I mean, you didn't have to really tell anybody. You didn't have to write out a big, complicated protocol. You just went over there where they were doing the fetal lambs and said, hey, why don't we make a diaphragmatic hernia? And make it. And then says, well, maybe we ought to fix the diaphragmatic hernia. You fix it. And we just did
while
it.
While the fetal's still in the womb.
Yeah, but this is lambs, that, fetal lamb. Right. And then at the same time, since I thought we could probably introduce the thing clinically, but it was so radical that it was really sort of scary. It was scary to a lot of people. And then there was the culture problem of working on a fetus as a surgeon, because you had the mother doctors, the obstetricians, who are very protective of their turf in looking after mothers. You had the baby doctors, the neonatologists, who are very protective in looking after the babies. And then we were the outsiders coming into town and saying, hey, let's do it before birth. And it took many years of going to their meetings every week and then bringing up things to convince them that it was reasonable.
What are the things that convinced them to do it, to let you do it?
Well, for one thing, they're all scientific. They're all faculty guys. So they were very impressed that we were doing all the work in lambs, and we eventually did monkeys, that we did all this animal work, I mean, a lot of it. And we did it carefully, and we published it and peer-reviewed it and presented it at meetings just like we're supposed to. So we got our way into their confidence by playing their game. And pretty soon, at the clinical meeting, which was every Tuesday at noon, we'd go to their meetings, and they'd talk about it. And by that time, prenatal diagnosis is getting pretty good. The ultrasonographers were getting pretty good. They could see things. So they would say, we just saw a fetus that had a blah, blah, let's say a diaphragmatic hernia. And then we'd say, if we really wanted to save that kid, we'd think about doing it before birth. And you'd have to do that many times over a couple of years to then people start accepting it. Oh, we have a diaphragmatic hernia. We had to think about fixing it. we got in with them. And then they were great allies.
Okay, the obstetricians.
Yeah, the obstetricians and the pediatricians.
Okay.
Our chancellor now was one of our colleagues then in the fetal newborn enterprise.
So he was kind of Sam, part of the beginning.
Yeah, he was there at the beginning.
So what was the first case like? What was it? Was there a lot of publicity to it at that time? Or
no, because from the beginning, we set a number of criteria for ourselves about what it would take to do the first human case. And one of them was a very difficult one. We said we had to do it in the most rigorous animal model and have the baby survive and the mom not do well. And that was the monkey. So that's non-human primates. We had to go all the way up to Davis and do those. And we did some of them on the Parnassus campus. So that was when you had to prove the physiology in a model. That was usually the fetal lamb. You had to prove the safety in a more rigorous model. That was the monkey. And you had to get your colleagues on board and go to the ethicist and talk to them. And we pretty much jumped through all those hoops. So the first cases were pretty simple things. We wanted to do the simplest thing first. The simplest thing was not diaphragmatic hernia. That's hard. Was a urinary tract obstruction. Because now you had just a obstruction to the flow of urine. If you could relieve the obstruction, you'd save the kidneys and save the kid and all that stuff. So we the first cases were that. That first successful case, we, of course, write them all up. Oh, that was the other rule. We had to report everything. Everything's on the table. Good or bad or ugly, it had to be on the table. So that first thing we did, we figured out a way to do it without actually doing surgery. We could do it with the needles and catheters and stuff. That catheter still is being sold around the world as the Harrison fetal bladder shunt. And that first kid we did is now, he must be in his 30s. Anyway, we see him once in a while. He lives in Florida, but he comes out and for meetings and stuff. Michael, he's a good guy.
What's his name?
And he was a twin.
Oh, he was a twin. Okay. But you don't have to do a surgery on his twin.
No, the girl twin was normal, and he had this bad obstruction. But it's interesting because as we developed the enterprise, as we went along, we said that was become an ethical problem of whether you should do anything for an endangered twin if it endangers the other twin. Because you could argue, and so we decided later, many years later, not to do anything in that circumstance, even though that was the first one and it worked perfectly. Because you could argue, oh, you do something to try to help one kid and it triggers preterm labor, and the other kid, they both die. So,
is there a study that shows that?
No.
It's just
thinking through it with our ethicists and stuff.
Do you think that's something that will change one day?
Well, yes, it already has. Because it's like everything. It's just a question of weighing risks and benefits. So if you have a huge benefit like saving a life and a small risk like doing something with needles, then it's justifiable. In fact, the most common fetal therapy procedure done today is done for twins. It's actually done because they're twins. So there's a thing called twin-twin transfusion. You have two twins if they have to be identical. And what happens is in a lot of them, they share a blood supply in the placenta. And if it gets unbalanced, then one kid gets too much, and one kid gets too little, one kid gets big, and they kill each other by this blood flow thing. So we go in and interrupt the blood flow. It's pretty easy. It's pretty safe. It's turned out to be a good procedure.
So that one is allowed.
Yeah, that one's allowed and encouraged because it's really worth it.
So you were saying earlier you use more the catheter and then eventually move on.
Some things. So when we started, we were so early in the enterprise and in surgery that really the only thing we could do was either to operate the old-fashioned way, open the uterus, take the kid partially out, do something, stick him back in, close everything up. Those were the tools we had available. It was before endoscopy. The first open procedures were done that way, and we did, eventually. Some things can only be done open. They just, like a diaphragmatic hernia, you have to sew stuff. And then later on, many years later, when laparoscopy and thoracoscopy and those things came along in adult surgery, then we adapted them first for babies and then for fetuses. And we call that Fitendo, because you work on it, you know, like you work on a screen. Anyways, it was like the kids' game.
So it's more like your video game skills come in handy.
Yeah, exactly. Except that we were a pre-video game, so I didn't have any skills.
This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based medtech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into unique healthcare solutions. For more information, you can visit their website at www.iolifescience.com.
So you started the fetal surgery center here, and what is that?
Well, in order to have an enterprise where surgeons, pediatricians, neonatologists, obstetricians could all mingle and work together on every patient. I mean, in other words, they didn't see patients in isolation. We would often see them together. And particularly important for when you had a life and death decision, and that everybody, that all the views are presented to the patient who gets to choose, of course. So we developed a very good system where we could all work together, and we named it, so we had to name it something, and we named it that. And it had no, we just made it up. We just made it up. We didn't go to anyone and ask them if we could be the fetal treatment center or, you know, anything else. We just started writing it on our letterhead.
So do you then train a lot more surgeons to do what you do here?
Yes.
And then transfer?
So in those early days, the most amazing talent came through our lab. I don't know how we were so lucky. Most of them were surgery residents in the middle of their surgery training, often here but also from other places, who would come and spend 2 years with me in the lab. And they did the huge amount of work and creative work that launched fetal surgery. I mean, I think in retrospect, we did 1,500 fetal lamb operations and 500 fetal monkey operations. That's a lot of work over many years. So these fellows, when they came through, because it was such an interesting enterprise, they all got hooked and then went on and did their training. And many of them went on to, well, essentially all the fetal centers in the United States were started by our guys and are still run by our guys, like the really good, big, successful ones.
So you said you have the lab, and the lab is to find a different way of approaching the fetal surgery? Is that what
you mean?
The lab they're hanging out with?
So we did, we have always, from the very beginning, had a research laboratory component to our thing. It's always been there. It's never gone away. And that has many components, but one of them is you have to raise the money to to run the lab, have all those animals and pay all those people. So we have continuously writing grants, and we've been very well funded, supported by NIH and FDA and all these people. But we've always done that, and we're doing it right now. So right now is there are three great young surgery research fellows, one of them from two of them went to MIT and are engineers, which we love. And then one of them is at Columbia University training, and the other one's at University of Texas training, and the other one's from the University of Washington training. And they just do great work, and then they'll go on and do cool stuff in the world.
That's great. It's like you have a lot of friends.
Well, I think they have fun. It's really fun to do this creative stuff.
And how long
they make it up. I mean, they make up stuff. I was on my way over to talk to you, and Asim was following me, trying to show me this new thing he just thought of for a way to treat esophageal atresia. And he says, And now that what they do is they make the damn things and they 3D print them. So he said, yeah, I'm going to go over and 3D print this thing right now. Let's start looking for a patient. I mean, it's really fun. It's great to have.
So you're still active.
Be involved with young people.
Yeah. So you're still active in the lab.
Oh, very.
And how long have you been doing the fetal surgery?
The first fetal surgery in the world was done in 1981 or two. Okay. So it's, and it was a very slow ramp up in those early years because we were trying to figure out what things to do and how to do them. And actually that leads to the device story, because in fetal surgery, it was so brand new to the world that there were no guidelines and certainly no techniques or devices. So we had to make them all up. So a lot of that first, all those first years, we're making things. Like we had to make a stapler to open and close the pregnant uterus. We had to make tons of stuff. We had to make radio telemeters to keep track of the fetus's heart rate after you put him back inside. We had to make devices for the surgery. We had to make up everything. In doing that, we did that out of necessity, and it was fun. But in doing that, I sort of got hooked on making devices and innovations, just almost independent of fetus. And so I started doing it for the kids after birth, different things like sunken chest or, you know, things that you could fix. And we've been doing it ever since. That's really how the whole device thing started at UCSF.
Right. So you started a couple companies, at least the one that I know
of. Yeah, and that's way down the road. So now we're working along, doing devices just sort of on our own. Then we get the FDA support for the PDC.
And then
the Pediatric Device Consortium. And we've had that now for 9 or 10 years. And that gave us a little infrastructure, some engineering help to do these devices. Now, in that later work, we came across a couple of things that we think are valuable enough that we want to get them out to the world. And then we're in the middle of that. We have not succeeded in that yet. So that's the magnemosis device that makes connections in bowel using magnetic force. Another device that fixes obstructive sleep apnea. So those two, and many other devices that didn't seem to have a big potential commercially, because they were for small markets, they were for kids with, you know, funny little things. But these two have potential, and so that's what we're pursuing now.
And how active are you in those two companies?
Very. So the way ours started is very slow and very, just a few people involved. So there's a guy, Michael Dante, who I've worked with for many years, even in the fetal stuff. And so he and I basically figured out how to do the intellectual property stuff through UCSF, how to get the patents, how to protect things. And then we learned, because we knew nothing about it, how to do startups and try to raise money and organize that and all that stuff that we're still doing.
Yeah. So are you stepping back from the surgery now already?
Yes. No, I don't do surgery anymore. I'd stopped about 8 or 10 years ago.
Do you miss it?
I missed it a lot initially because it's really fun to operate. Because by then we could make up things in the OR. I mean, I had almost... We just go on, even with common operations or common things, say, oh, there's probably a better way to do this. And we can, and there's a lot of latitude to do that. So I very much miss that. But I recognize that I shouldn't be doing it because, you know, when you get old, you're not that good anymore. And the young people are way better.
Do you think the robotic surgical device would help that?
Probably. I was just before the time when the robot really became used commonly by surgeons. So I barely ever used one But yeah, it might help with that. Mm-hmm. But still, it's not right for the old folks to. I saw some old surgeons here and at other places who shouldn't have been operating, who still were. Mm-hmm. That's just not right for the patients.
Yeah. So do you think, because you mentioned that in your days, you can do all these things.
Yeah.
And now there's a lot more.
Absolutely.
Restriction. And how can we still promote, like, you know, what you've done for the field of surgery is great. How do you balance that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the history is when we started doing this fetal stuff and having to make up all these things, we did things that you could never do today. But just because of the regulations and the FDA regulation, but we had our own internal ethical system that was pretty robust, probably as good as it is anywhere at any time, including today. So we never got in trouble. We never got in trouble. And I don't think we hurt anybody. But we tried lots of new things. That was at a time before the FDA had anything to do with devices. You know, in the old days, they were just drugs. Isn't that their name? Federal Drug Administration. Yeah. So they didn't have anything to do with the devices. And then later, and I don't know exactly when, but they said, okay, we're going to regulate devices. And they brought over the very strict regulations from drug development, which really, in many cases, didn't fit for devices. So we went through years of just terrible battles about regulations and the FDA. Since then, over the last number of years, they've mellowed and they have gotten better, and we've gotten to know them, and so we work with them all the time now. Well, they fund us now.
Yeah, so can you tell us more about that?
Well, I'll tell you the history of it. So 10 years ago, somebody in Congress, some politician-type person, recognized that kids were getting shortchanged, particularly in device development and also in drug development. And the reason was pretty simple: small market. So if you're developing a drug or a device that will serve newborn babies with diaphragmatic hernias, you're in trouble because there's no market. That's, you know, like 2,000 cases a year when you really need 10 million. So they went, I think it was a mandate from Congress that said we have to have some way to promote development of new devices for small markets and kids. And that's how the term Pediatric Device Consortium came about. For some reason, when they, usually you would think they would go to the NIH, the research arm, and that they would administer, because they're used to administering that stuff. But for some reason, they went to the FDA and gave the FDA a certain amount of money and said, try to promote kids' devices. And they came up with the business about the pediatric device consortiums, and they put out a call for people to apply for this grant, pretty small grant. And there were a bunch of people who applied, most of the, you know, the pediatric centers. And they gave out three grants, and we got one of them. So it was Michigan, Harvard, and us. And we're the only ones who have kept our grant throughout all the years as they renew these 1 and 2 year grants. So I think we've done a good job. We've certainly developed a lot of stuff, and they like us, I think. And then it came last year, they said, oh, we got more money this time from Congress. And so what we want to do is convert it to a bigger 5 year grant and open it up to everybody in the country. So it was very competitive. And there were only 5 given out of these 5 year grants, and we fortunately got one of them.
That's so great.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Well, it takes a heat off for a while.
Yeah. At least now you don't have to apply for another grant for another 4 years. until the 5 years expired.
Yep.
Yeah.
This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based medtech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into unique healthcare solutions. For more information, you can visit their website at www.iolifescience.com.
One of the things that we first met was maybe 5 years ago when we started the idea of the Rosemann Institute that came about. And I believe I connected you to Dan Rosemann.
Yes, you did.
You got to know him. So that was...
Well, we loved Dan, and we were very excited. So when we talked about Magnemosis, we were just starting to on the idea that we would have a startup and try to commercialize and do that whole thing. And we didn't have the foggiest idea how to do it. So we viewed him as our savior, and he started down that path, and we lost him.
Yeah, so that's... Life goes. So, you know, even though you're no longer doing surgery, but I found that you're still really, really busy. The Pediatric Device Consortium, now with the new fund, they'll probably make it even busier.
Yeah.
What are other things in your docket that? Being a fetal surgeon, probably you work 90 hours a week.
And I was a pediatric surgeon, so you know, I had the regular pediatric surgery practice. So yes, we were very busy then, and I'm not, because now I don't do that whole clinical part. That's a huge amount of time and effort. I don't do that anymore. But that allows me to do more of this. So we meet 3 times a week now with the surgery fellows and talk about new projects and develop things and have prototypes and do all that stuff. And that keeps me busy.
Is there anything that's exciting that you see that's coming? And what's, you know...
Oh, there's lots of stuff.
What space and what space?
Well, the other thing is that instead of we've always been sort of selfishly interested in our own projects, like the things we've talked about. We love those projects. But now we're more resource. The Pediatric Device Consortium is a resource for many, many other things. And you know, we meet here every Tuesday at 4, from 4 to 5. And there's usually 15 or 20 people, as there were yesterday, of a wide variety, mostly not doctors, mostly engineers and entrepreneurs and folks, and hear about all these great new projects. So we're constantly exposed to new stuff that's not ours, which is really interesting.
Does that make it more fun?
Yeah, much more fun.
You got to see variety.
Yeah. Oh, huge.
Yeah. So how, you've been here at UCSF for a good while.
Forever.
How has it changed in terms of like with the device ecosystem and innovation, entrepreneur?
The thing that's really changed on that front is, first of all, I think UCSF rolled the dice many years ago, 20 to 40 years ago, and they won. They seem to do things right. They got the right faculty. They have all these superstars all over doing all these great things. I lived next door for many years to to our guy who got the Nobel Prize, Stan Prusiner.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And, yeah, I mean, they're just... They seem to win on everything. And when they moved down here to Mission Bay from our Parnassus campus, where I was for most of my life, they really hit the jackpot because this is a beautiful thing. And they, again, I think they rolled the dice and said, well, if we bring the UCSF science down here, then we'll attract other not UCSF science to build things around us. And that's exactly what happened. So this is just an amazing complex, an amazing amount of building and stuff. So UCSF is really winning.
Yeah. Do you think that was deliberate? Or you can't just be lucky all the time?
I don't know the answer to that. It must be some luck. But they basically have good people. And yeah, it's... The other thing that's really changed, now that's the big picture, now the little picture for us and devices is we from the beginning wanted to work with engineers who would, you know, who had the skill, and it was just a different world. And we couldn't. We couldn't make the connection. We would get in our car and go over to Berkeley and go to their engineering department and say, hey, we got these problems. We got to fix this. We got this. We got that. And we could never make a connection. And the reason was that in those days, the Berkeley engineering and science was so theoretical. They had, I mean, they were, you know, all they wanted to do was publish in, you know, these fancy journals, this high-minded stuff. They didn't want to make stuff. They didn't want to, have, you know, do practical stuff. So we just could not make a connection, tried for years and years. And that is has really changed. That has really changed. Getting guys like Shubho Roy and that whole bunch of folks, engineers, to be here with us and meet every day and come to the PDC meeting is just fabulous. So now you put the docs who have needs, they know what the problem is, and they have an idea about how to solve it together with the people who know how to make the things that will solve it. It's really productive.
Yeah, I mean, when you're doing your fetal surgery at the beginning, you have to make your own.
We had to make our own. So
how do you do that?
Okay, so when we, this is actually sort of fun. So it would be, you know, we were working in the operating room with the kids and thinking about the fetuses, and then we're going to the lab up there to do the fetal surgery stuff, and we need tools, we need stuff. So I went down to the basement of the Parnassus and found a machine shop and a guy named Art who ran that little machine shop, one-man thing, but he had all the tools, and he could do stuff. And then I found a little bit later a guy, Rich Fechter, who basically was the fix-it guy for the operating room. So when you're in the, you know, when the machines break in the operating room, they call his little group, and they come and fix it, whether it's computers or microscopes or anything. So they're master fixers, and that guy is really good, and he loves magnets. He loves magnetic force. So with that little, you know, a machinist in the basement and Rich Fechter in the operating room and us making up, you know, needing things, we got a lot of that stuff done and a lot of things made.
Yeah, well, that's good. You're very resourceful to make things happen.
Well, I like to work with people.
And, yeah.
And they don't have to be fancy people. Have to be people
who cares.
Yeah.
Good people.
Yeah.
And fun people.
Yeah.
So, but well, last question before we end this conversation. I've been asking people about what books they've been reading. What books pop in your mind that you're reading right now? That
I just got to think of them. So we just went back to visit my son, and I gave rounds at Columbia University on this innovation stuff. So I always get a book to read on the airplane. And this time, well, right now I'm reading the book by an Indian fellow about growing up in India. Rory's his last name. The God of Small Things. Have you ever read that?
No,
it's very entertaining. But just before that, I read a book. Oh, this is good because it's UCSF. I read a book by, I'll think of his name in a minute. But the name of it is The Hacking of the American Mind. And it's by our guy, and he's a friend of mine. He's the big pediatric diabetes guru, and he's the big anti-sugar guy.
Rob Lustig.
Rob. So this is his latest book. It just came out. The Hacking of the American Mind. So he writes about, and it was fascinating. He just like, he wrote a book before called Fat Chance. And it basically said processed sugar is a toxin. And I think he's right.
Yeah.
And
it just tastes good.
Yeah, it does. And then, and this book is a follow-up to that, but further, how the food industry, because they're so powerful and so profitable, the processed food industry, has figured out pretty much how to hack our minds. That is, to figure out the science of pleasure and pain and taste. Gain and taste and all that stuff. The actual, you know, hormones that are doing it, the dopamine and all these things. So he loves that stuff. But he uses it as a way to show how the guys who have the money and the power have know how to influence us. They absolutely have hacked our minds to like this processed food and to do certain things.
Yeah.
So that was really an interesting book.
That's a good recommendation. It's interesting. I think there was an article in New York Times talking about that for the video game.
Yes.
How the neuroscience.
Yeah, it's
evolved.
The science of addiction.
Right.
And how you get a hit from playing the video game or having sugar or or taking dope or something. And each time, I didn't appreciate this, but each time you get a hit after that, it has less effect. So down the road, you need to have four hits to get the same pleasure that you get out of that first hit. And that's the definition of addiction.
It's like coffee.
More and more, yeah. You need more and more and more to get the same feeling, and then you're hooked.
And you remember that feeling. You want to keep getting that.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, that would be good read for me through it later this year. Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you.
That
it was fun,
fun,
Christina. Yeah.